listening to Faith and Reason. This is your host, Dr. John Pinheiro. And for about the next hour, we're going to be talking about fertility, NAPRO technology, and what the Catholic tradition has to say about these matters. You know, a big question in the modern world for a lot of folks, if they suffer from infertility to one degree or another, is that how far can they go and remain in accord with Catholic teaching and Catholic moral teaching? In vitro seems to be increasingly popular. I know I myself saw a television program some time ago with a couple who was unable to have their own children. And they were obviously a Catholic couple, I thought, because they were crossing themselves and saying the Catholic grace over their meals. But they were heavily involved in vitro fertilization and were going at it time and again and running up huge bills, despite, of course, the other aspects of that. And I thought, here's some people who just don't know. You know, they think they're doing a good thing or an okay thing. So what I thought we'd do to answer these questions is invite a doctor and a NAPRO medical consultant into the studio here. And we have with us today Dr. Kimberly Barrows, who earned her medical degree, medical doctor from the University of Toledo, and in her residency at the Family Practice Residency Program in Columbus, Georgia. And just more recently, she graduated with NAPRO as a NAPRO technology medical consultant in April of 2013. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Thanks, Dr. Pinheiro.
So, Dr. Barrows, I thought we could start off with just defining the term infertility. I've talked to some. I remember my wife and I had infertility issues for a number of years, and sometimes young couples would come up to us and they would say, you know, we've been trying for 3 months and we haven't had a baby. We're suffering from infertility. And I would always think, well, you know, try several. I meant to say 3 months. And then, you know, try several years, and then, you know, at what point do you start to think, well, what do we mean by infertility then? And how do we talk about it as a couple as opposed to an individual being infertile? So what does this term mean exactly?
Most of the time when we're discussing infertility, and sometimes we use the term subfertility because couples don't always have and don't usually have a absolute infertility. But when we have low fertility, we're talking about a couple that has been using any time of the day of the month, random acts of the marital act any time during the month, not trying to avoid pregnancy and not conceiving in a year.
Okay.
Sometimes with older couples over 35, especially where the woman is over 35, we may begin evaluation and treatment when it's been 6 months of random intercourse and no conception has occurred, just because we know that they have a biological clock ticking and their fertility is already a little less sometimes because of the age. But generally, after a year, that's when. So 3 months would not be considered usually infertility.
Okay. Would I be wrong in thinking that there's more subfertility or infertility today than in the past? I know people used to welcome a lot more children into their families in the past, of course. We know this from historical examples and the size of families, and especially Catholics, of course, still do that, but not many. Mm-hmm. I wonder, sometimes people these days will limit family size on purpose, and sometimes it's a matter maybe of subfertility, but there seems to be more of a problem with this than in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah, infertility truly is on the rise, and the studies show that the incidence is going up. And in the 1995 study that I saw, 6 million women were affected with it. Now it's about 9 million women, so there is an increase, and it's been over the last 20 to 40 years that we've really noticed that increase.
I saw a story last week. It listed, I forget which West African country is having the highest population replacement rate. It was something like 6 children per person or per couple, and the United States had actually dropped a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We were at 2.1, which
yes.
is a little bit better than 2, and at least above 2 is where you want to at least be at a replacement level. But, of course, a lot of that U.S. number is even due to immigration. So I wonder, even in prosperous countries, there seems to be less purposeful reproduction, and in less prosperous countries, more. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, less purposeful reproduction or trying to avoid pregnancy for long periods of time can lead to problems that then when one wants to conceive can be a problem. Like I mentioned before, just as we age, everybody's different as far as when their fertility will severely decline, but generally it happens around age 35, and then after 40 it declines even more. And when we talk about fertility, we also talk about primary and secondary infertility. Primary infertility is not being able to conceive for the first time. Secondary infertility is after having successful pregnancies and deliveries, then not being able to conceive after a period of 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
And another reason why delaying pregnancy can also add to infertility is because when people are able to separate pregnancy and sexual activity, then some people are more promiscuous, and that can lead to sexually transmitted diseases. It can lead to pelvic problems in the woman, and that definitely causes an increase
in infertility. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have statistics in front of me, but my guess would be, of course, that the marriage age or the cohabitation age, we might want to say, in America these days is quite a bit higher than in the past. And
yes.
So that means at least until there's people intentionally having children, that's they're going to wait quite a while for that.
Right.
And there's a fertility curve then, isn't there?
Yes.
More fertile and less as you grow older. So maybe I'm sure there's lots of factors, cultural factors, physical factors, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
There is something we call fertility care. There's all kinds of approaches to this. We're here to talk about a very Catholic approach that you're involved with today. What is the general state of fertility care today in the United States?
Today, fertility care is mainly in the realm of the reproductive endocrinologist. Most people will go to a reproductive endocrinologist after they've had a basic exam and physical with their OBGYN doctor or their family practice doctor. And then a lot of times the evaluation isn't continued to a really great degree at that point. Trying to find the reason for the infertility is really important, but it's sometimes short shrifted because of the technologies that have developed that are very highly technological, but they're also they can be very invasive to the marriage relationship. So a lot of times people will start off with blood work. They'll do some imaging of the woman's reproductive tract. They'll do an evaluation of the husband too, and then they'll start with perhaps some medications that will either induce ovulation or help treat a disease such as polycystic ovarian disease, and they will try and induce ovulation and then go to some more invasive technological approaches such as intrauterine insemination, and then usually it goes quickly if that isn't successful to IVF, and IVF has some other technologies that can be associated with it, such as intracytoplasmic sperm injection. They also have some procedures called ZIFT and GIFT, which actually put either the gamete, which is the egg and the sperm put together in a petri dish and then put into the fallopian tube. They transfer it to the fallopian tube. They can do that even before the egg and the sperm have come together in the petri dish, and that's what the GIFT procedure is.
What's the price tag on some of that?
The price tag for the evaluation and the medications tends to be in the low hundreds. That's not a terribly expensive thing, and some of it will be covered by insurance because it is looking for disease process and treating a disease process. However, once you get into those technological advances, those are not well covered by insurance. They're not covered at all. And those
insurances are more likely to cover birth control than they are something like
right.
Yeah.
And when you're trying to work with infertility and doing some of these what they call assisted reproductive techniques, they can run $10,000 to $12,000 per cycle. And generally, if the success rate is about 25%, then most people are not going to have a baby at the end of one cycle, so it usually leads then to another cycle, unless someone drops out either due to finances or just because of the emotional toll it takes on them.
This this is big business, it sounds like, from several angles. One would be from the research side, because if it's big business from the other side, then, of course, going into the research of this, that must be major business. So you've been through medical schools. Do you recall people who wanted to go into this field or saw it as particularly lucrative?
I personally didn't know anyone that went into that field for the lucrative part of it. But I do know that it is big business, and it's a $4 billion business right now. And so it is, and a lot of complaints I've heard of and read about online of what goes on in, after an infertility visit with the physician is right away they're shuttled off to the financial people to help them with providing or figuring out how they're going to pay for this. And then they feel somewhat abandoned by the medical community because the first thing that they talk about after meeting with the physician is how are they going to pay for this. So that's been a frustration for a lot of people. And it also limits who can use this technology. Right now we only are serving 0.5% of women with this technology as far as helping them deliver healthy babies of all the women that are affected with infertility.
And Of course, the flip side of this, and speaking of babies, is you can probably explain this better than I can, but the way in vitro works, there's a lot of lost children in the in vitro process, which is why it's condemned by Catholic moral teaching, right?
Right. Yes, that's one of the reasons why it is condemned, is because, in general, you waste 6 embryos per live birth with IVF and those procedures. As well, there's the insertion of a third party into the marital embrace, and that is also condemned by the Catholic Church because that is not part of what God's plan was for marital couples and procreation.
So every person has the right to have a mother and father involved in their creation, right?
Right.
And to be born in that and created in that natural way, and that's a matter of the right of the baby, right?
Yeah.
Not of the parents, 6-1. That's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I guess I meant earlier when I said I think some people don't know that. And they to spend that much money, I assume people want children very, very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they're willing to go through that. And if they have the money, then they think it's a good. So it's a good example of a desire that maybe is it gets disordered somewhere along the line into maybe a disordered desire that they want them so badly they're willing to do this, but I don't know that they always know the consequences. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have another set of questions would be to wonder what level of education Catholics or others are doing to talk about the 25% success rate. The 6-1, the 6 mm-hmm. children lost to everyone who's able to be to be born.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any education being done?
I know that Pope Paul VI is very involved in education. They have not only training medical doctors, both family medicine doctors and internal medicine doctors like myself, also OBGYNs who then can also do the surgeries involved and general surgeons. But they also have a huge lay ministry of trained fertility care practitioners who are not necessarily from a medical background, but they've had extensive training through the Pope Paul VI Institute to teach couples how to chart. And then in addition to that, the clients that we have usually are so appreciative of our services, it's really not hard for them to spread it to all their acquaintances, their people they know on Facebook and other social media and in their church. Some of the fertility care practitioners are starting their own practices without a physician in lots of different cities. They're training others to do this, and they're going and speaking to lots of different places, as well as the doctors talking about it. So I think the information is getting out there, but not as fast as we'd like.
And that Pope Paul VI Center that's located in Omaha, Nebraska.
Right.
But people could reach that online at Pope Paul VI, Pope Paul VI, PopePaulVI.com. And let's talk a little bit more about Pope Paul VI. So he was vilified by some and praised by others, and his predictions, in my view, seem to be fairly accurate about the consequences of birth control and the downhill slide into abortion and sex selection and everything else that we have now, promiscuity and sexually transmitted diseases and the rest of it. So to talk about Humanae Vitae for a moment, I wonder sometimes if we don't need an update to that simply because there's so many new technologies that there may be that there's a lot of questions about. Mm-hmm. And there may be mention of these in the catechism or by inference in Catholic teaching, but a one-stop shop would be nice, maybe. I assume that maybe the Pope Paul VI Institute maybe has something like that. Or
yes, they have a lot of patient information and good information to give out to priests. They even have a seminar called Love and Life Unlimited that they also offer to lay people and priests. And then the Couple to Couple League International also has some great information. In fact, their Family Foundations magazine was where I found a great chart that listed out, yes, this is what the Catholic Church says, yes, 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 go for this. These things are no, and these things are, the Catholic Church hasn't said anything about it yet.
Okay. Now, Couple to Couple League, that's mostly natural family planning. Is that what, mm-hmm. what they're involved in?
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't heard of them in a while, but good, very good. So when it comes to a Catholic approach, then, to fertility, so if we've established, let's say there's a couple and they're subfertile, as you call it, or infertile,
mm-hmm.
and they're weighing lots of options, I think maybe adoption's an option. They certainly want children, but also they'd like to try to birth their own children as well. So where should they go then? It sounds like unless they already have a doctor who respects their religious beliefs, or a Catholic doctor, and these are not always easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
I could speak from experience in moving to a new city and moving to Grand Rapids and trying to find an OBGYN for my wife that would not be encouraging her to sterilize herself the moment we walked in the door. We
mm-hmm.
we finally landed a good one on the third or fourth try, but it wasn't easy. You just kind of have to ask around. I mm-hmm. think in some cities, but. But where would we start as a Catholic couple? What would we want to do first?
Okay, there are several resources online. First of all, the word of mouth, like you said, is a great way. I would also go to One More Soul, which is a website, One More Soul.
Is that all one word, One
mm-hmm.
More Soul?
One More Soul.
Is that .org or .com, do you know?
I believe it's .com.
Okay.
And they have a list of NFP-only physicians. So you don't always have to find one that only will do NFP and won't prescribe any birth control, but that's helpful if you can find that. And if you find an NFP-only physician, then there's another subset of those physicians that are trained in the Creighton Model System, which is what the Pope Paul VI Institute uses in NAPRO technology. And if they're trained in NAPRO technology, they can help even more intensively with the problems that have to do with infertility, problem pregnancies, postpartum depression, even things like PMS, ovarian cysts, and things like that. They can treat it in different ways than generally most of us are trained in medical school, and how I was trained in medical school, even though I had a Christian perspective going into medical school and looked for those things, that wasn't really offered. The things that Dr. Hilgers has studied in his research at Pope Paul VI Institute was not something that was presented to us. And I wasn't aware of it until 2004 when I actually met him at a meeting in California.
So this old myth of the Catholic approach to birth being merely this, or NFP, Natural Family Planning, being simply a rhythm method, that's old news.
Yeah, this is
it was
not
never
your
entirely accurate in the
right.
first place. But so we moved to there's that Billings method. There's others out there. But when you throw in the word technology, there seems to be a different implication beyond simply reading the body's signs
mm-hmm.
Of fertility or infertile periods and that kind of thing. So
mm-hmm.
maybe it's a good moment now then to talk about the Creighton model and what NAPRO technology is, and even what the term means,
yeah.
NAPRO. Why don't we do that?
Sure. Well, NAPRO technology means natural procreative technology, and that name was coined by Dr. Hilgers. He was really inspired by Pope Paul VI's Humana Vitae and felt like the call for scientists to come up with a scientific method of regulating birth and tracking a woman's cycle was almost speaking directly to him. So he took that on as his mission. And after 25, 30 years of research, he's come up with not only the Creighton Model System, which is a standardized method based on the Billings method. He actually went to Australia and studied with the Billings to learn everything they knew about natural family planning. And he standardized it so that everybody across the world that's using this system uses the same language. It also is laid out with stickers and a chart that you can look at with a glance and tell mm-hmm. sometimes if there's problems. It tells so much more than what generally we can find out in a doctor's office, even with the history physical and all the expensive lab tests and radiographic type of evaluations that we can do. So it tells us a lot. And then in addition to that, he's done studies on what should be the normal hormonal levels throughout different parts of the cycle, as well as throughout the different weeks of pregnancy, so that mm-hmm. with checking on those hormone levels, we can do a much more extensive evaluation, and we know what the mean is, what the standard deviations are, so we know how to treat it, and we know when someone is having a problem. For example, in pregnancy, the progesterone levels can be a huge range, something like they'll say between 20 and 480 might be your reference range at some labs, and that's considered normal. But that doesn't tell you very much, because it's a lot different when you're at week 4 of the pregnancy. You've only been pregnant for about a month versus when you're 9 months pregnant or when you're in the midst of pregnancy and start bleeding. It's really important to know what those progesterone levels are and then to treat it in a way that we can monitor. Okay, are we giving too much? Are we not giving enough? Whereas most of the time when we're treating it by standard of care, we don't have that normogram even available to us. The only lab I know of that has that is the one at Pope Paul VI in Omaha, the National Hormone Lab. And so other labs can do the testing, but as far as interpreting the results, you really need that normogram and the work that...
And health insurance would cover all
yes.
that, you think?
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not considered a... extraneous test of some kind?
No.
I guess, okay.
No, progesterone test is a very standard test and very inexpensive, even if you don't have insurance.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm. Well, what about on the side of trying to conceive then? So you were talking about pregnancy a mm-hmm. little bit there. So my curiosity would be, you're a young or not so young Catholic couple, and you're trying to conceive, and you want to know how far can you go? Your doctor says, try some Clomid. Is that okay? Try this, try that. How far can you go? How far is too far? If you start out with Napro, what all do you all do with when it comes to drugs, for instance?
Okay.
You know, when it comes to hormones and injections, something like that, that's mm-hmm. what's allowed, what's not allowed. It's all very complex, and I think one of the amazing and beautiful things about this show is about the Catholic intellectual tradition, but this is really part of it. We're talking about Catholic moral teaching and bringing our scientific minds and reason to bear on these natural problems that people face in their everyday life, and that's one of the amazing things about the Catholic tradition. But sometimes the moral teaching it finds itself, the church will find its head spinning a little bit. Technology moves so fast, and all of a sudden there's 30 new questions the church has to answer that it's never had to answer before, except in maybe a slightly altered guise, right? So mm-hmm. 200 years ago, maybe it was talking about birth control, but it wasn't talking about some of this stuff.
Yeah, and keeps our ethicists busy.
Yeah, keeps them very, very busy. And I know some of this technology it's very cutting edge. And if you ask people certain things like... do you think it's okay to kill 6 babies in order to have one? I hope they would say no. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the, you know, you can't all about the subordination of goods yes. and doing evil to cause good. These are, I hope, pretty simple concepts out of mm-hmm. Catholic moral teaching.
Well, that doesn't even encompass the ones that are the embryos that are created and then frozen, and they're just
sure.
in limbo,
and
that's not including yeah. those. It's also not including the ones that the most heartbreaking thing, I think, is once a woman is pregnant, and with some of the technologies, there's definitely an increased risk of multiple births. In fact, the mm-hmm. multiple orders has births has and pregnancies has tripled since these technologies have started to become popular. And one of the most heartbreaking things is that sometimes something called selective reduction is what is recommended to the woman. And they are not going to likely know about this when they go in and they have some treatment done and then they're pregnant and they're excited. Then they find out they have multiples. Then the doctor tells them all the risks of having a multiples pregnancy and how it would be so much better if one of the babies, probably the one that they think is the strongest, would be the only one gestated for the rest of the pregnancy. And so they actually talk people into going in for a procedure where they inject potassium chloride into the hearts of some of the babies, and so that only one survives. And this is, I've talked to doctors that don't even know that that's a common practice in IVF, and I think they're trying not to have as many multiples so they don't have to do this, but this does come up quite often, and I think that would be the most heart-wrenching decision mm-hmm. to try and make. And then if a child were to...
It's not even an unforeseen consequence, really. I mean, it's a well-known consequence, and among
right.
the doctors,
right.
at least.
Right.
That's awful.
Yes.
So with the NAPRO technology then, and
yeah.
what the Paul VI teaches...
Mm-hmm. There's a lot that you can do. And I look at it as, what does the church say yes to? There's so much that mm-hmm. the church says yes to. They're fully behind an extensive evaluation. And at the Pope Paul VI Institute, where people come from all over the world, or at other physicians that have been trained in that method, so now people don't have to go to Omaha, they are going to give you the most extensive hormonal evaluation. And it is going to be all in one cycle. So yes, it is perhaps a lot of blood draws. There may be several ultrasounds, but it's all done in one cycle. It's much less invasive than some of the other treatments that may be done at other clinics, but it's very thorough to find the problem. And that's what our goal is to find the problem so that we can heal the body and allow the couple to conceive naturally within the marital act. So we also... Definitely, we'll use medications, and we use them aggressively, but we also use them in low doses because we've seen success with low doses, and it's much safer to use things in low doses, sometimes combinations of medicines. Surgery is often necessary, and while that may be invasive, there are a lot of laparoscopic approaches that can be done, so things aren't as invasive as they used to be. But surgery can be extremely successful in certain things such as endometriosis and polycystic ovarian disease. They can be much more effective in helping women conceive than even using the more cutting-edge technologies of IVF. So when you see that that's more successful, it doesn't insert another person into the marital relationship to cause conception to happen. It allows it to happen naturally. Most women are definitely okay with a surgery in the hands of a very highly trained physician.
You've used the word successfully, and it mm-hmm. makes me recall I was talking to some of our Grand Rapids diocesan seminarians a while back, and I said, well, what do they tell you when you're at the seminary about your vocation? And they said, well, the first thing they told us, I think Father Ron Hutchinson tells them this too, that if you go to the seminary and you discover that you don't have a vocation, they think that's successful. That's good. You've discovered, you know, that your vocation lies elsewhere. If you discover that you do, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't want to force them into it. So I wonder, when you talk about success, there must be cases where are there cases even at the beginning of the first test that you just see and you look like, yeah, this is not happening? You might, you know, if you want children, you should go right into adoption, or maybe you should look for, maybe there's some other vocation you're drawn into that you could put your time and energy mm-hmm. into, or spiritual adoption, if you've heard of that, you know, especially, you know, poor and needy kids around the world could use help. So there's all of that too.
Yeah.
You probably don't factor. I thought by success you were implying, I mean, success means to conceive, but would it also be successful to say, look, this is the way it is, mm-hmm. and at least that they know they can go on, they can move on to something mm-hmm. some other way?
Yes. Well, that's definitely seen as part of the part of the final evaluation might be suggesting that to the couple and supporting them with adoption. I do think, though, that most couples that have been told by other doctors there is no hope for you, surprisingly, there is a large number that they can be helped by NAPRO technology, even if they've had failed IVF procedures or several of them. So it's rare that you can, on a first evaluation, say this is not happening.
Sure.
That's pretty rare. But when a good amount of testing, evaluation, and treatment has been done, we do lead the patient to looking towards that option okay. as well as a beautiful option. And NAPRO technology is one thing that is, people need a little bit of patience, because anything that's caused a problem did not develop overnight. So to fix the problem, it takes a little bit more time than overnight as well. So several months in the evaluation process than several months in the treatment phase. But we will generally help people for a year or two when they realize, okay, this is more treatment than I want to do, we will help them also with the adoption process if that doesn't happen. So it depends on the diagnosis. There's generally a 32 to 82% success rate as far as having a healthy pregnancy and delivery, but that varies a lot depending on the condition that the couple has. So.
Okay, and earlier, when you were talking about some of the ethically unacceptable ways of doing it, you said 25%?
Generally. A little higher for people younger than 35, but it's much lower for people who are over 35. And a lot of times the people that are seeking that treatment are older than 35 and even older than 40. It goes down to 18% after 35, and then age 40, I think it drops down to about 8% success.
The success rate then is higher. 32%. I'm not a mathematician. I'm a historian, but I think that's higher than 25%. Why not more doctors using this are going to be trained there? Is this they see this as a how would doctors involved in the field of in vitro fertilization or some of the other ethically unacceptable methods how would they view Paul VI? You think would they look at this institute as that's kind of the religious wackos in the center of the country, or do they respect it? I would think with the scientists and doctors that success rates speak for themselves, and you do what works or it doesn't work. Maybe not.
I would think.
Yeah, I have this vision of higher education too, where all the students are just there to learn and gain knowledge for knowledge's sake, and we're there to impart wisdom, and there's no bureaucracy involved. But that didn't turn out to be the case either.
Yeah. Well, there is a little bit of definitely some bigotry involved, old ways of thinking, such as this is your grandmother's rhythm method, but this is not. And they have there are a lot of physicians.
I don't think my grandmother knew half the words you've used today, so it's probably not.
Yeah. A lot of doctors don't know about it. I think that's the main thing. I don't think it's that they think anything negative about it. They just have never heard of it. And when they've never heard of it, then they question, well, why is the medical establishment not jumping on this? And that's the case with any new discovery, is that at first, when no one's heard of it, you question, does this really work?
Okay.
I question that sometimes myself when I see some amazing diet pill that's going to like help you lose all your weight in 3 weeks, and you think, and it's totally healthy. You know, you kind of question that.
Why is everybody? Sounds too good to be true. It might be usually.
Right.
Okay.
But with NAPRO technology, the success rates for things like polycystic ovarian syndrome and endometriosis are 63%, 57% for endometriosis, 82% for anovulation, meaning the woman's not ovulating.
Those are some of the most common causes.
Those are the more common causes. It's usually a multifactorial thing, but those are the more common causes. And I think when the tubes have been damaged, that's where it goes down to maybe 32%. Mm-hmm. But in general, most cases are much higher than that. And the some of the surgeries that they're doing at Pope Paul VI, they've compared it to Johns Hopkins studies where they did similar surgeries, but they didn't use the NAPRO techniques and they didn't do the charting and everything to help the couple know with fertility-focused intercourse when to conceive. The rates were still higher than when it was done at Johns Hopkins because of the additional knowledge that the NAPRO physician has.
Well, it sounds like that with the combination of technology and surgeries and medicines, but also with these natural techniques, my sense is that I thought current physicians were getting drawn more to more holistic methods. And some of my favorite doctors have been the kind where, you know, I go in, I tell them a problem, like, yeah, I could prescribe something for that, but why don't you go home and eat this or eat that or exercise a little more or something. Mm-hmm. And I always appreciate that. Like, if I could do it without drugs, I'd rather do it without drugs. I was telling Dr. Barrows before the show started how I haven't eaten in a couple of days because I had been got some food poisoning. And I remembered my doctor in Charlottesville, who was a great doctor in Charlottesville, Virginia, had told me never to drink water on an empty stomach. It would just make things worse. He had said to drink ginger ale, but here I am drinking water. I'm still standing. I'm sitting, actually. It's a good thing, maybe. But he was a physician who rarely would prescribe unless he absolutely had to. And, you know, I appreciated that. And he seemed to imply that, now maybe it was just Charlottesville. It's kind of a kooky place. But he seemed to imply that that's where the field was going. But maybe not.
I think that's true, and I think that's being pushed by patients wanting that.
Yeah. And so NAPRO seems like a natural then. I mean, it seems very attractive to that kind of thinking. So, well, let's look at your cycle. Let's track these things in a billing style way. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of young Catholic couples who practice NFP from the get-go. It's not mm-hmm. something they have to relearn, because, like my generation, the generation that largely rejected, the Catholic generation that largely rejected Humanae Vitae, mm-hmm. if the numbers are correct, and I think they're pretty correct, I mean, it was pretty high, 80-90%. I mean, it's pretty high, particularly mm-hmm. in America. But the children of that generation, you know, they're having to learn it at church and from people like you, but they certainly don't have it passed down from their parents in a lot mm-hmm. of cases. Mm-hmm. So, but there's more and more of this out there now. And mm-hmm. I like what you said earlier when you said, let's look at what the Catholic Church says yes to, mm-hmm. instead of just looking at yes. the anathema list of the things you can't do, and you find out there's a lot there.
There is. And I think that NAPRO technology encourages what the new focus in medicine is, which is partnering with a patient to make them an equal partner in their health care. Physicians are consultants, and we're consulted for our knowledge, but the patient has to do most of the work, most of the hard work.
It doesn't seem fair, really. I want to go to the doctor and have them wave a wand and be better when I go.
And the great thing is the husband can really help the wife with this, so it's not mm-hmm. all on the wife, but with her knowledge, she's educated, I think she's empowered, and I think she really feels confident in going into that doctor's office and saying, this is what's going on. Do you know what could be causing that? What could we do about that? And the physician, especially if they're NAPRO trained, they can help a lot with that.
But yeah, I was joking about that waving a magic wand, but it really does make the doctor a lot less like a shaman, doesn't it? If you know something about your own body and own right. life and what's going on, you've got some knowledge of your own. And I would say that knowledge shouldn't be, as a Catholic, shouldn't be simply the medical knowledge, but also the moral knowledge when your doctor's telling you that something's a good idea and you think that it isn't, right? Mm-hmm. Or you know that it's somehow unethical. Well, I'd like to talk for a moment about places people can go for more information. We said this earlier, but we're in the closing 10 minutes or so of the show. So why don't we revisit that? We mentioned the website, PopePaulVI.com. That's Pope Paul the VI, Roman numeral, right? VI.com. But also fertilitycare.org. Is another website people can go to, fertilitycare.org. Mm-hmm. What would they find at fertilitycare.org?
They'll find the fertility care practitioners, who are the allied health practitioners who will help them learn the charting system that then they can go and show their doctor, especially their NAPRO-trained doctor, will be able to interpret that the best. And the onemoresoul.com that I mentioned, that website, One More Soul from Cincinnati, has a list of NFP-only doctors. Pope Paul V1.com also has a list of NAPRO-trained physicians, so you can find a physician, hopefully, in your area.
But if they do these surgeries, do they have to do them in Omaha, or they
no.
can do them here? Okay.
Well, if your area has a NAPRO-trained surgeon, Grand Rapids doesn't, but Grand Rapids has some, with me being a medical consultant, and I know some people that to refer to. One is in South Bend, and one is in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And
those are the closest.
Are
so in Michigan, close. There's that.
Yeah.
That's very close.
Yeah, in Michigan, I don't know of a NAPRO-trained doctor that's a surgeon also.
Now, if you're a medical consultant for this, is there a place people can get a hold of you or call you to consult? How would they do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now I'm working on setting up my practice as we're new to the area, and I'm on maternity leave currently, but we have I basically have been giving people, telling them to contact me through my email.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's kim.dr, as in doctor, dr, at hotmail.com.
Okay, so kim.dr@hotmail.com.
Yeah.
That should be easy to remember. That's pretty good. I wish I had
And soon we should be up and running with it.
Okay,
practice.
Great. Yeah, so,
yes.
So you're new to Grand Rapids. I know you and your husband have been here since, I would think, August or
yes.
thereabouts, August of 2013. So how are you finding Grand Rapids? I know you've lived in quite a few places.
Lots more snow than I expected.
Well, me too. Me too. I've lived here 10 years. I'm still very surprised this past winter.
But, mm-hmm. but beautiful. The lakes are great, mm-hmm. and it's really close to go to some fun resort-type towns, so we really enjoy that. It's been great this summer, and then going into the winter, my kids have loved the snow, and they've seen more huge icicles than they've ever seen in their lives.
Okay. Yeah, I've lived here for 10 years, but I'm originally from California, then lived in the South the rest of my life, so I'd never seen real snow mm-hmm. until I moved here. It snowed once in my hometown of Bakersfield in the early 1970s, but only snows there once every 25 years.
Wow.
And by the next time, I was already gone.
Yeah.
But I never really actually had seen snow fall till I was living in the foothills of Appalachia about 10 years ago. It was fast. Even as a young kid, I was like a kid. You know, it was snowing. I can understand how your kids must feel with this much.
They love it.
You better give them a flag if you put them out there this year because they'll sink down into it. It's so deep.
Yeah. It's been more than Colorado Springs, more than Omaha.
Well, for my money, Grand Rapids is a great city. I like the mid-sized cities generally, and mm-hmm. this is probably the nicest city I've ever lived in. I'm glad to be here. And we have mm-hmm. listeners here on 1140 AM and down in Kalamazoo, 91.5 FM on Holy Family Radio. We're in the last few minutes here of Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. I'm Dr. John Panero. We've been speaking with Dr. Kimberly Barrows, kim.dr@hotmail.com, who's a medical consultant in Grand Rapids for NAPRO technology, natural family planning, fertility treatments that are in accord with the ethical teachings of the Catholic Church. And that have a very good success rate, as we've been talking about. And so we have just a couple minutes left, and I usually like to give guests the opportunity to promote, push, prompt, whatever they would like to in the last few minutes. If you had something else you wanted to add, something you wanted to say or okay. mention, now's a good time.
I would definitely encourage any young woman or more mature woman, or any couple to look into natural family planning as a method of birth spacing or for conception. It not only will be the healthiest method and in accord with the teachings of the Catholic Church, but it also is enriching for marriages, and it is come a long way since what our parents had to deal with. We have several organizations here in town that can help you with that. There's the Couple to Couple League that I mentioned before. They have couples that will teach other couples, and they're highly trained. Then we also have some Creighton Model fertility care practitioners, as well as the Billings Method is available. Whatever method, I think it is just it's helpful for women's health. It's helpful for their marriage. And then if there are problems that these consultants can definitely pick up on, these practitioners are very astute in picking up problems, then they can send you to their to a doctor that can help with that, whatever the problem may be. In addition to infertility and problem pregnancies, things like recurrent miscarriages, ovarian cysts, painful periods, PMS, as well as postpartum depression, a lot of things that you would be surprised about can be helped with NAPRO technology and don't need to resort to things that the Catholic Church is not in favor of or that is not medically good for your body.
And for those of you listening who are not Catholic, I would say these are worth looking into as well. I mean, you, I'm sure, have, if you're a non-Catholic Christian, you have ethical concerns as well, and maybe a desire to live more naturally, desire to have children if you discover that you seem to be unable to do that. I guess folks should start maybe with the parish priest to ask who in your parish teaches this, or they could email you and find mm-hmm, out. There's, mm-hmm. Maybe you know somebody. I know there's some folks in the campus ministry at Aquinas College. Eric Bridge and his wife are teachers of natural family planning mm-hmm. locally. And there's a lot more folks out there doing this than you might think. Don't believe the hype that you see on the BBC or here on television that the Catholics aren't interested in natural family planning, or that this is simply a rhythm method and the flipping of a coin. Mm-hmm. There's much more to it than that, and I think you'll find you'll be much closer to your spouse when you're involved in NFP, especially for the men who are usually kind of out of the loop on things involving the female cycle and that. I just recall from personal experience that being the case. Thank you, Dr. Kimberly Barrows, for coming on Faith and Reason today. Appreciate having you here.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Panera. I appreciate it.
In this next segment today, we have with us Mark Postma, president and founder of Catechetical Foundations. One of the things he's going to be talking about is the Authenticum lecture series. Many of you are already familiar with Authenticum if you're in the listening area. They had a great first year last year. We had both Mark Postma and his business partner, or I should say a missions partner perhaps, Michael Tober, on the program with me, and they talked about Catechetical Foundations as well as Authenticum, which is held at Sacred Heart Parish in Grand Rapids. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Really good to be back.
Good. It's good to have you here. And why don't you tell us what's coming up for Authenticum?
Well, what's coming up is the same thing we've been doing. We have monthly lectures. The neat thing is we're not only doing the Grand Rapids Authenticum, we've also expanded out to the Lakeshore. And we have Authenticum lectures happening out there every month as well. In fact, last week we just had our 10th official Authenticum lecture. So we have some great lectures coming up at Sacred Heart, and we also have some really great ones coming up on the Lakeshore as well. So,
well, here on Faith and Reason at the program here, we really like your lecture series. It does the same thing that the Catholic Studies program does.
Yeah,
that
is,
you're focusing on truth and beauty and goodness and on culture and not on what I would call secondary and tertiary elements.
Yeah, that's right.
So why don't you give us an example of what we can expect beginning in May with Authenticum and going on into the summer?
Yeah, this one in May is going to be fantastic. It's one I'm looking forward to possibly the most out of the next 4 or 5 months, actually. And we have Dr. David Whalen coming over from Hillsdale College, and his mentor was Dr. John Sr. And if you haven't heard of him, look him up. You really want to look them up in conjunction with the University of Kansas in the 1970s. And they started a program called the Integrated Humanities Program there. And hundreds of conversions stem from that program. And Dr. Whalen's going to talk to us a bit about that program, Dr. John Sr., the restoration of Christian culture.
And that was at a public university.
You bet. You bet.
And I think
they ended up getting ran out of there.
They
sure did.
Shut down.
They sure did.
So, what's Dr. Whalen's connection then to John Sr.?
I'm not sure if he studied directly under him or not, but he was mentored by Dr. Sr.
I see.
Actually, he did graduate from that program several years after the program was closed. However, it may have ran to a certain capacity that I'm unaware of. So
I plan to attend that one myself.
I plan to find the answer to that one when I meet him in a few weeks.
The one thing I remember from John Sr., whom you've actually introduced me to in a very large way, is mentioning that we ought to read good books before we can read great books.
Yeah, you
and
bet.
That's maybe something.
Yeah, he advocates the 1,000 good books, and in the back of his work, The Death of a Christian Culture, there's the list of the good books, and I counted them, and I was really distraught because it didn't count. It didn't add up to 1,000.
It really didn't. Well,
no, but there's a lot.
Have there been 1,000 good books written? That's a good question.
Yeah, you bet.
So what else besides moving on from John Sr.? That's on May 1st, right? Thursday evening, May 1st.
Yeah, you bet. And then I'll highlight June 5th as well, and that's going to be Father Aaron Ferris, the pastor up in, I forget where he is, up in Remus. He's the associate pastor up there, and he's spoken with us before on St. Athanasius and the Incarnation, and he's going to come back to talk about the Christian meaning of human suffering. So that one's sure to be a good lecture as well.
Is he a chaplain in any way to the series? I've seen him at many of the lectures, but of course Father Peter Damian I've seen there as well.
Yeah, since he's the associate at Sacred Heart, mm-hmm. So he shows up a lot. Father Ferris is actually directly involved with Catechetical Foundations. He's on the board, and he is our spiritual advisor as well at this time. So the one I'm looking forward to the most, perhaps, out of these, is going to compete a lot with the John Sr. lecture, is in August.
I love the title.
Oh, yeah. Reasonable Pleasures, the Pipe, the Pint, and the Cross. And we have Dr. Marshall coming back from Aquinas College, of course, a colleague of yours in the Catholic Studies Department. And he just gave a fantastic lecture on unnatural unions in January, of course. And this one I'm really excited to hear about because I know he likes Chesterton, and I know he likes things that we would put under the banner of leisure.
And as the title says, Reasonable Pleasures. I assume we'll find out a distinction there between the reasonable and the unreasonable.
You bet. And I've found Dr. Marshall to be a reasonable man, so that should be very good.
Anything else special about the August 7th event?
Absolutely. So we usually start at 6:30, and we start in the gym at Sacred Heart, and with hors d'oeuvres, wine, cheese, all that good stuff. And the lectures start at 7 o'clock. This one's going to start at 5:30 p.m., and it's going to be outdoors in between the parish and the school, the church and the school buildings. And we're going to grill out. It's going to be Reasonable Pleasures. We're going to have the pig and the cow going on the grill. We're going to have beers, homemade beer, actually. We have two or three people committed to brewing some of their own beer and bringing that. Cigars are welcome. Pipes are welcome. Fellowship is absolutely welcome. And the lecture will begin at 7 as well. We also have a couple of high school students who are going to provide some live music for us as well during this event.
Oh, it sounds like a great, well-rounded event.
So if you're going to bring some friends and invite some non-Catholics, this is the one to really bring them to, really shock them into.
Well, we'll show them how we do it. So in other words, we've got the Reasonable Pleasures there, the fun, the fellowship,
the faith,
the food and drink, and then, of course, the faith and a very deep, abiding and intellectual faith.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And then the last one that
This one sounds probably, I'd have to say maybe.
This
maybe
one might be all right. Yeah. This one, of course, features yourself, the Christian view of history. So maybe you want to share with us a little bit about what we're going to do there.
Well, right now at Aquinas College this semester, that is the spring semester, I'm teaching a course that I teach every other year called the Christian view of history, named after an essay written by Christopher Dawson, whose work and thinking on Christian culture forms the foundation of the Catholic Studies program that I directed Aquinas. And the Christian view of history is about the way Christians view history, or ought to view history, or have viewed history over the ages, compared to people of other faiths. And it was Dawson's contention, and I find this compelling, that Christians in many ways invented history compared to the way ancients understood history. They understood history in a very circular way, and repetitive events and chronicles of in the reign of King so-and-so, and Christians come along and they say, look, we know that history has an end and it has a beginning, and the center of history is the incarnation, and what comes before that is leading up to it, and what comes after is the life of the church and the church leading up to our final end, not only our individual final end in God, but the end of time. And so I will just be, I guess, presenting Dawson's view on the Christian view of history and talking a bit about St. Augustine and how the things that many people think are important in history, the rise and fall of empires and great states and politicians, those might turn out to be the least important things or tangentially important things.
Right.
But sometimes what's important is the decision of a young, wealthy man to turn his back on the wealth and rebuild the Church of San Damiano. That could be important.
You bet.
Me witnessing to somebody could be of very prime importance 500 years from now for somebody else who, at the end of a long chain of events, is going to revitalize culture in some way.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. I think, just listening to where you're going to go with that, that's the key to these Authenticum lectures. One lecture stands out to one person completely differently than one will to another. We had Father Phillips from St. John Cantius out last November, and that talk was very good, very informative talk. Some people said that was the best talk they've ever heard. Your talk on Lepanto, which kicked us off last October, every time I put CDs on the table, it's gone. And then the January one with Dr. Marshall, that one right now is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
It hits different people different ways. And because we're hitting on truth, we're hitting on just simply that, the good, the true, the beautiful. And it's going to strike people at different ways. So different topics are going to appeal to different people. So I think it depends on what minute I'm looking at this list on which ones I'm most interested in. So we do have two more currently scheduled as well. In October, we have Mr. Steve Ayers coming back. And he's the one who recited the poem Lepanto and gave us a little intro to G.K. Chesterton.
Great job of it. Very powerful reading.
Riveting. And he's going to talk to us about the life and the works of Father Gerard Manley Hopkins. So that should be absolutely fascinating. And in November, we have Duncan Strike coming from Notre Dame. And he's going to talk about the art and architectural contributions, the thought of Benedict XVI. Really looking forward to that.
That's wonderful. You know, when we started the Catholic Studies speaker series.
This is your first one, right?
Duncan Stroik was the first one we invited back in 2009, I think it was.
Is that still on the website, the Catholic Studies website?
His talk was not recorded. We weren't recording them yet. We started recording them after that. But I recall Duncan saying to me, John, why would you start off with an architect? And my answer was because churches are creations and chapels are creations that stand the test of time and live beyond the current generation, long into the future. So that if we want to think about Christian culture and the most obvious element of culture and the most visible element of culture, it's these churches we build. So they better be permanent and they better be better.
First thing that may inspire a child might be the church building itself.
Sure.
Huh?
I mean, Thomas Merton says that when you walk into these cathedrals in Europe, you can just feel the people who prayed you to where you are today.
You bet.
And so, Stroik, well, I'm glad to hear you're having Stroik, which reminds me, I should say to our listeners, we've been talking with Mark Postma about the Authenticum Lecture Series, which is a ministry of catechetical foundations, and attendance at these will earn you catechetical catechist credit in the Grand Rapids Diocese, and I think not just the Grand Rapids Diocese, if I'm correct.
Officially at this point. Okay. How it is in other dioceses is up to them, but we do have the official word from our own diocese.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on the show and filling us in
great.
Here.
Yeah.
Mark Postma, what else do you have for us today?
Well, one big event that we have coming up here is on Saturday, June 14th, and it's going to be held at Sacred Heart Parish from 9 a.m. to 3:30 or 3:45 p.m., and it's the day for catechists. And this is going to include 4 hours of certification within the Diocese of Grand Rapids, and we're going to have a keynote speaker and 3 breakout sessions during this day. It's simply designed for catechists. It's a free event. It's just donations only. If you feel so moved, we ask for a donation. We're going to provide a great outdoor picnic lunch. And if it's going to be rainy, we'll have a great indoor picnic lunch. And it's simply a day for parents, college professors, teachers, and Catholic schools, catechists in the parish, discerning catechists, priests, deacons, etc., paid employees in the church, to come and to have a day of fellowship and being instructed in catechetics, and to lay that foundation and be renewed in what it is we're doing and why we're doing it, and also to get some tips on how to be a more effective catechist. Our keynote is going to be by Father Ferris. Again, he's involved in catechetical foundations as one of the board of directors, and he's going to speak on the catechist and the missionary mandate of the church. And that's going to get us kicked off for the day. And we have 3 breakout sessions throughout the day. One is learning the language of the faith, which is going to focus on the catechetical documents as well as some of the words we hear in those documents. They're not all English words, right? The faith is universal. So what are these words? We find a lot of catechists, unfortunately, maybe a good majority of catechists aren't familiar with catechetical words, and we need to be, you know. Another session is going to be on Scripture as the driving force of catechesis, and finally, one we're calling building blocks, going to focus on some of the foundational principles that should be involved in any catechetical presentation. Mike Tober, myself, we're going to be presenting those sessions. I believe Jim Penrice, the DRE from St. Mary's in Spring Lake, is also going to assist us with one of those sessions.
Will any of this be recorded, audio or video?
All of it will be recorded, yep. For video, possibly. Audio, absolutely. And we also have Brian Pizzolatto. He's the new director of catechesis from the Diocese of Lansing, and he's going to be coming out to give one of the sessions as well. I've known him for years, and he is a genius when it comes to this material. So
Looking forward to that. Good things happen in the Diocese of Lansing, and it's good to see some cross-germination there. Now, where can people go who've been listening to us here talking about Authenticum, talking about your day for catechists? Where can people go to find out more information in case they're driving in their car right now and not texting and not taking notes?
Yeah, you're right. You go to catfoundations.com. I'm not going to make people type catecheticalfoundations.com. It's way too hard to spell and way too long. Catfoundations.com. It's all there. Authenticum is also on Facebook. It's just facebook.com/authenticum, I believe.
Okay.
But, catfoundations.com. There's clear links to all the Authenticum lectures. They're all on the website. They're all free. If you want a CD, just drop us a line. Drop us an email. We'll send one to you in the mail. The Day for Catechists, the registration form is online. You can also sign up online. So it's all right there. Buttons are clear. So,
well, thank you very much for being on the program. This is Dr. John Pinero. I've been talking with not only Dr. Kimberly Barrows, but also the last few minutes with Mr. Mark Postma, who, along with Michael Tober, run Catechetical Foundations. Thank you for listening to Faith and Reason.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.